Good afternoon. Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward. Today, Speaking in Maine takes us to the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations to hear Serhii Plokhii. Serhii Plokhii is the Mikhailo Hrushevsky Professor of Ukrainian History at Harvard University. Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast from our website. Introducing Professor Plokhii is Mac DeFord of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations.
Good afternoon and welcome to our second June meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout on Maine's soon-to-be warm and sunny Midcoast. And a particularly warm welcome to our radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the president of the Forum, which was founded in 1983. For over 31 years, that's over 350 meetings, the Forum has been gathering on a monthly basis to hear an invited expert from the world of the Foreign Service, academia, international businessmen, journalists, talk about critical foreign policy issues facing the United States. Today, we're delighted to have as our speaker Professor Serhii Plokhii, who is Mikhailo Hrushevsky Professor of Ukrainian History at Harvard. His research interests include the intellectual, culture, and international history of Eastern Europe, with an emphasis on Ukraine. His latest work is The Last Empire, The Final Days of the Soviet Union, which came out just last year. Okay, we're delighted to have Serhii Plokhii talk today about Ukraine and Russia.
Thanks a lot for this wonderful introduction. Also, thank you for inviting me to Maine to speak in front of this audience. The invitation has special meaning for me because when I was doing research on the book that appeared last year and in the paperback this year, The Last Empire, that was the first time that I got to Maine from Boston. I wanted to see the place where President Bush has his family residence, because many of the key decisions related to the end of the Cold War were made here in Maine. And again, from that point of view, this today's presentation for me has special meaning. One of the arguments that I make in the book in general, but in particular in the introduction to the book, to the paperback edition, is that what we witness today in the region is really the continuation of the saga of the disintegration of the Soviet Union, which I refer to as the end of the last major European empire. There is a number of contexts in which we can put in the disintegration of the Soviet Union and what is happening today in the region. One of them would be, of course, the rivalry between Russia and the West, and there are good reasons to do that. But if you take a broader chronological frame, in my opinion, the proper way to understand these things is to think about the fall of the Soviet Union in the same line as the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire, or the fall of the Habsburg Empire, or the end of British, Portuguese, or French empires. Really, the 20th century turned out, we talk about communism and liberalism and nationalism and two world wars and one Cold War. But the essence of what happens in the 20th century, for me, is represented in, if you would compare two globes, the one produced in the year 1900 and another produced in the year 2000. And the number of differently colored spots on that globe would increase from 50 to close to 200. And that's in my. That's the result of the disintegration of the empires. That's the outcome of the creation of new nations or state that try to be nation, and also the mess associated with that, war, suffering, and other really unpleasant things and developments. Well. I started with Maine and with the decisions that many of them were made here in Maine at the Kennebunk port. But apart from decisions, there was some heavy involvement also here and in Washington as well in myth building and creation of a mythology, in particular mythology about the end of the Cold War. And the predominant narrative today in the United States, the way how I understand it when it comes not to the expert community, but it comes to the public in general, is that the Cold War not just ended, it ended with the victory of the United States in the Cold War. And the symbol of that victory was the fall of the Soviet Union and disintegration of the USSR. Well, what I'm trying to show in my book is that the collapse of communism, the end of the Cold War, and the collapse of the Soviet Union were related things, but not exactly the same thing. The disintegration of the Soviet Union was never part of American agenda in the war, or Western agenda in general. More than that, working with the materials in President Bush's library, for me, there is no question that until almost the very end, until December of 1991, the United States did everything diplomatically possible to keep the Soviet Union going, to keep it from collapsing, for a number of reasons. Nuclear proliferation, they got a good partner in President Gorbachev. The real relations were developing the way how Washington wanted them to develop for a long period of time. The trick is, and to, in my opinion, a problem as well, is that this is mythology that is not just unique to the United States. It is something that is shared with Russia and with President Putin in particular. Except that this mythology is viewed with different, either as plus or minus, as positive or negative thing. If in the U.S. context this is a positive thing, in the context of the Russian policy and policies of President Putin, this is basically an indication of how the West and U.S. in particular was interfering into the affairs of the United States, how they brought the humiliation of Russia. And this is as very much the very important narrative in today's Moscow, including a recent interview to Charlie Rose that was given by President Putin in St. Petersburg 2 days ago. So if what I'm telling you about the fall of the Soviet Union and the role of the United States in the wiping out that country from the map of the world is mythology, what then is quote-unquote truth? What really happened? Again, part of answer I already provided to that. The U.S., for a number of reasons, very good reasons, that were viewed as national interest of the United States, but also of the world in general, were trying to keep the Soviet Union going. So who was responsible for killing the USSR? And my argument in the book is that the real perpetrators, the real two major forces that led to the fall of the Soviet Union were not outside of the USSR. It wasn't President Reagan, it wasn't President Bush, it wasn't Mitterrand or anybody else. They were the two largest republics in the Soviet Union that in 1990 and 91 could not find any more common language and the way to continue existence in one state. Those two largest republics were Russia and Ukraine. And it is the tensions and disagreements between those two republics that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union in December of 1991. So here you see the leaders of those two republics at that time in 1990, the future presidents Kravchuk of Ukraine and Boris Yeltsin of Russia, signing the first interstate agreement between the two countries, between the two republics, that was still The situation was the sign-in was taking place in the summer of 1990, before the coup in Moscow of August 1991. Well, the coup in Moscow really changed a lot in the dynamic of things in the Soviet Union. Again, the way how normally things are perceived is that there were hardliners, bad people who wanted communism and who wanted, didn't want market economy and didn't like democracy, and they rebelled against Mr. Gorbachev, who wanted all these things. But thank God, because of the strength of democracy, the coup collapsed and Mr. Gorbachev came back. That's more or less narrative and story. Well, the story behind the scenes is that as a result of the coup, Mr. Gorbachev lost power and never regained it. And the coup, the military coup of August 1991, was followed by a counter coup in Moscow, which was not backed by the military, and which was led by Mr. Yeltsin of Russia. As a result of that coup, Mr. Gorbachev was stripped of most of his powers, being forced to revoke his orders and decrees on appointing his Minister of Defense, his Minister of Interior, his head of the Security Service, and signing decrees appointing people suggested by Mr. Yeltsin. So the what we see in August and September of 91 is really Russian takeover of Moscow, Russian takeover of the center. Formally, there would still remain for a number of months two presidents in Moscow, Gorbachev and Yeltsin, but the real power would be now with Mr. Yeltsin. Real power meant not only appointment of the ministers of defense and security and so on and so forth. The real power was also controlling the money. And the money was coming from oil and gas back in 91, like they come today in 2015. And it was Russia, starting in September of 1991, that began to control that money and the as a result budget. By November of 91, the Soviet Union was still around. Mr. Gorbachev had already no money to pay even his secretaries. And again, that's the dynamic that is not always understood. What that means for for the story of Russian-Ukrainian relations, this is, I like this picture, Kravchuk looking at the watch, time is up for the Soviet Union. What that meant for the relations between Russia and Ukraine was that the Ukrainian referendum on December 1st, 1991, that puts an end to the Soviet Union, Ukrainians more than 90% voted for independence, was not really about the independence from the Soviet Union. The referendum was about the independence from Russia, which has effectively controlled the center. And it was the relations between Russia and Ukraine in December of 91 that decide what would happen and what would not happen in the Soviet Union. The two countries had different visions and different perspectives on what would happen in the USSR. Here is a picture that on the right you see the architect of Russian economic reforms, Igor Gaidar. And it was in October of 91 that Mr. Gaidar told Mr. Yeltsin that we don't have any more money to keep the empire going. We need this money to rebuild Russia. And in October and November of 91, Yeltsin and Russian leadership decide to go their own way, not politically, but economically. Not to wait for reform in other republics, but start their own reform, which eventually leads to the disintegration of the one common economic space in the Soviet Union. They were going economically their own way, not anymore prepared to share the profits from oil and gas with other republics, but they were not prepared to go their own way in political terms. And that's why already in late August and in September of 91, for the first time, you see voices coming from Moscow, from people around Yeltsin, his spokesperson, saying that if Ukraine and other republics, Kazakhstan in particular, decide to leave the Soviet Union, Russia has the right to raise the question about the borders. And in particular, the questions were raised about Crimea, eastern Ukraine, and northern Kazakhstan. Because of revolt in the republics and pressure of the United States at that time, Yeltsin had to back off. And those questions were postponed until later, until the Ukrainian referendum of December 1st, 91. At that time, Gorbachev and one of the best-known Russian writers of the period, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, were saying that with the referendum in Ukraine, the votes had to be counted region by region, which meant that if in a certain region there would be no less than 50%, that region is not joining independent Ukraine. And the results of December 1st, 1991 referendum came as a surprise to many in Russia. So not only that more than 90% voted for independence, but in the Crimea, there were more than 50% for largely Russian enclave, ethnically Russian enclave. More than 50%, 54% in particular, were for independence. In the Russian Navy base or Soviet Navy base, Sevastopol, the vote was even higher, 57%. Navy personnel could count. They counted the Russian seas, and they all happened to be in the north or in the far east. So the only warm sea that the Soviet Union had was in the Crimea, in the Black Sea. So if they wanted to stay in the Crimea, they decided that they would have to go with Ukraine. Again, it changed. The fleet. The fleet was eventually taken over by Russia. But it is very interesting that on December 1st, 91, Sevastopol was voted in larger numbers for Ukrainian independence than the rest of the peninsula. So when, after December 1st, the three Slavic leaders met in Belavezhe, there are Mr. Kravchuk of Ukraine, Shushkevich of Belarus, and then Yeltsin of Russia, the negotiations were really between Russia and Ukraine. Belarusians provided venue. You see that Mr. Shushkevich is kind of confused a little bit. He's not sure what is going on. He told the Russians, okay, guys, you are big guys. Whatever you agree, Belarus was 10 million people, Ukraine 54, Russia over 150 million people population. So whatever you decide, we'll go along. And it was there in December that they couldn't find the formula for coexistence in one state. Later, they declare on the second day of negotiations the Soviet Union to be dissolved and the Commonwealth being created. A few weeks later, the Central Asian republics joined the Commonwealth. But the decision was made between the leaders of the two countries, stressing the point that the two main stakeholders in the Union couldn't agree anymore on the way how to continue with the Union. I didn't mention names of Mr. Reagan or Mr. Bush too much, but again, this is not to say that U.S. wasn't part of that. U.S. really and people in the White House were not sure what to do. The events were developing so fast. So the key thing that was at the center of U.S. concerns and U.S. policy was the nuclear safety. So once the basic agreements were reached, Mr. Yeltsin calls Mr. Bush from Belavezha, from the middle of nowhere. They have trouble getting to Washington. In Washington, they don't understand where the call comes from and who these people are. And then he reports, before talking to Gorbachev, about the agreement reached, asking basically for American approval, but also assuring Bush that they reached an agreement according to which the nuclear arsenal will be under one central control. That was the major concern at the time. The nuclear arms didn't disappear from the agenda, U.S. and international agenda in general, with the disappearance of the Soviet Union. So it took another few years, up until 1994, when the agreement was reached for the transfer of the nuclear arms from the Soviet republics like Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Belarus, which were nominally nuclear states by the fact that they had physical control, not operational control, over nuclear arms. So it was in 1994 that the agreement was finally reached. And part of that agreement was that the Ukrainians insisted that there would be a special statement made by Russia, United States, Britain, then later France, and it was joined in a limited way by China as well, which eventually evolved into so-called Budapest Memorandum of 1994, according to which, in exchange for giving up nuclear arsenal, not guarantees but assurances were given to Ukraine regarding its territorial integrity and sovereignty. So when in 2014 the Russian troops took over Crimea and then Russia engineered war in eastern Ukraine, among other things, that was also a violation of the Budapest Memorandum by one of the guarantors of the security and independence of Ukraine. Now, some of the policies that we witness playing out today in the region, they start in the 1990s under Mr. Yeltsin. In effect, a Cold War that ended up all over the world, that means the competition between Russia and the West, never came to an end on the territory of the former Soviet Union. There was major cooperation in the 1990s anywhere in the world between Russia and US and the West, but not in the former Soviet Union. That Russians considered that territory to be their sphere of influence. The West never agreed to that, and it was left to that. So there was this unresolved issue hanging on from the period of the disintegration of the Soviet Union from 1991. What changed with the change of guard in Kremlin from Yeltsin to Mr. Putin was that Russia started to play a much more active role in bringing the republics that were looking westward under their control. There were covert operations, and eventually there were also open operations. Here is a picture of one of Ukrainian presidents. On the left, before he was running for the president in 2004, and then another one after he was poisoned. That was the period where a lot of people who were not on good terms with Russia got poisoned with all sorts of unheard of, either nuclear substances or chemical substances, so things that could be produced only in a country with a highly developed chemistry and nuclear industry as well. So Russia gets involved into events that became known as Orange Revolution, but eventually loses the bid. It was Mr. Yushchenko, the pro-Western president, who was eventually elected. And since 2008, we see the major change in Russian foreign policy. Russia was at war since 1991, starting to stop the disintegration of the USSR. That war in the 1990s was war in Chechnya. So the Russian troops were used within the borders and boundaries of the Russian Federation. In 2008 comes a major change, and this major change is related to the fact that Russian troops for the first time cross Russian borders. And Russia uses not only soft power or covert operations, but also or financial pressure, economic pressure using oil or gas, but also military outside of its borders. And this is related directly to the NATO decision to consider Ukraine's and Georgia's membership in NATO. The next time the Russian troops are again employed outside of Russian borders are the events in Ukraine of 2014 and 2015, which combine elements of the military operation, so-called hybrid war, but also a major propaganda offensive. And there is a bunch of those maps. You can find the world, how it looks from Washington, or the world, how it looks from Paris or Kyiv. This one is the world, how it looked in 2013, 2014 from Moscow. And the idea was to discredit. By the way, look at what happened with the Crimea. It left the place where it's normally docked, south of Ukraine, and got attached to the Crimea. So, and Ukrainian territory is divided into New Russia, and those who in Moscow believed would oppose the most, they were called fascists. And again, the trick was to sell this idea to the West, how the fascists want to be part of the European Union and are in favor of democracy and so on and so forth. So you have this definition of Euro-fascists. What we have in Ukraine today are attempts to basically, on the part of Russia, I'll go back, it's better. So to achieve a number of goals, Ukraine started to move westward in terms of signing association agreement with the European Union. And during President Yushchenko also had claims for joining NATO before it was said, okay, not now, not today. So the idea was not just to stop Ukraine's drift to the West. The idea was to integrate Ukraine into the new structures, economic, military, and political, the Eurasian Union, which was one of the major Putin's projects once he came to power as the president for the third time. Once that didn't really happen, the next project was annexation of the part of Ukrainian territory, that means the Crimea, and then splitting the rest of Ukraine in half with mostly Russian-speaking areas, the southeast, creating a new state which would be called New Russia, a Russian puppet state, and the rest of the country, Ukrainian-speaking, which on the previous maps were called Euro-fascists, becoming kind of a smaller Ukraine, which would be stripped of its economic potential, industrial potential, and so on, and would be easier to manipulate. So it was the idea of, if we can't get all of Ukraine, we can get at least half of Ukraine. And the model was based on the idea that, as far as the Russian language goes, Ukraine is the country that is bilingual, and the predominantly Russian-speaking areas in the east and Ukrainian-speaking in the center and in the west. The idea was that once the Russian militias would enter the Russian-speaking territories, there would be a major uprising. Well, what happened was that parts of that territory really the Russian strategy succeeded, and it's the industrial areas, the coal mining areas in eastern Ukraine. But the rest of Ukraine, actually, after some confusion and hesitation, we see the mobilization of the Ukrainian society in general, and a mobilization around the idea of nationhood and identity that was very different from the one that was suggested and proposed by Russia. If Russian was based and is based on the idea of Russian language and Russian culture, what Ukraine at this point actually proposes against this model is the idea of a civic nation which is not based on culture and language but based on values and based on the pro-European orientation of the region and of the country. So we face here a situation that is not completely unfamiliar for most of the empires and imperial nations once the empires disintegrate. There were hundreds of thousands of Germans and Hungarians left outside of Austria and Hungary after the fall of the Habsburg Empire. The Turks and Turkic-speaking and Muslim population in the Balkans and other parts of the former Ottoman Empire. What is different about Russia and the way how the whole issue of the disintegration, painful issue of the disintegration of the empire is handled, is that Russia really is not sure where its borders end and where its national identity ends. Mr. Putin keeps repeating again and again, last time in this interview with Charlie Rose, that Russians and Ukrainians are the same people. And if Russians and Ukrainians are the same people, that means that they eventually have to be either in one bloc or in one state. And this is the process of unfinished formation of Russian nation and Russian identity is something that probably will be a problem and follow us in the future, because unlike with other empire, with British or with French, we have the imperial nation, the core nation, that really is not sure about the boundaries, cultural, linguistic, and geographic boundaries of its identity. So on this not very optimistic note, that it looks like there is more to follow, I'll end my presentation. A good part of what I said is in my book, and I certainly encourage you to get it. I heard somewhere that buying book is the moral equivalent of reading it. Thank you.
Okay, what they do is they bring questions up and I pick the questions so that you don't have to. Yeah. Great. Serhii, thanks a lot. Let me start. How about this one? This is a good first question. If NATO had not set its sights on Georgia and the Ukraine, might Russia have not gone into Ukraine? How much of it was NATO and the U.S.'s fault?
Let me get to the mic. This is the argument that Mr. Putin makes again and again. And the way how the annexation of the Crimea was sold to the Russian public was that, well, if we would not move in, the NATO nuclear arms would be in Crimea. This is in the situation when after the Bucharest summit in 2008 and after the war in Georgia, the membership for NATO for Ukraine was not part of even discussion anymore. It was removed from agenda. So what is happening here in case of Ukraine is not Russia's attempts to stop the expansion of NATO, stop the expansion of European Union. This the real and bigger motivation is of a different kind. This is an attempt to create its own bloc, economic, political, and military, Eurasian Union, that would be on par or would be able to compete in all those terms with European Union on the one hand and with rising China on the other hand. So it's about not exactly restoration of the Soviet Union, but this is about the restoration of the control over the former Soviet Union in a different way, much cheaper way than it was during the Soviet times. And project like that is impossible without the second largest entity, the second largest country in the former Soviet space. So it's like the Soviet Union was impossible or Russia lost interest in it once Ukraine was not part. Now the reintegration of the space doesn't make much sense for Russia without Ukraine. So at least in my reading, this is about building something in that space, not stopping the advance that wasn't there already for at least 6-7 years. Thank you.
Okay. How vulnerable are the Baltic nations? The questioner goes further, Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, to Russian influence, to Russian aggression?
Well, what we see in case of First Georgia in 2008 and in case of Ukraine in 2014-2015 is Russia's use of minorities, either Russian-speaking or non-Russian-speaking, but use of minorities. And that was one of the reasons why Hillary Clinton and a number of other people also were comparing Russia and what Mr. Putin is doing with Germany and Hitler before World War II, the use of Sudeten Germans with entangling of Czechoslovakia and so on and so forth. So again, it's politically incorrect comparison to compare anyone to Hitler, but for historians, you can't prohibit to do comparative studies. So let's compare Russia and Germany. So what that means that if this know-how Russia will continue to use it. Of course, North Kazakhstan is the next possible target. That made Mr. Nazarbayev really very unhappy. Mr. Lukashenko, the last dictator of Belarus, became very friendly with Europe and European Union because his country, the majority of the population outside of the villages and the major cities, speak Russian. So if Russian is a definition of Russianness and provides the right for Moscow to intervene, he is really in trouble. And out of the Baltic states, of course, the most vulnerable in that context would be Latvia, where there is a significant ethnic Russian and generally East Slavic or Russian-speaking population. Russian-speaking population, it's not necessarily ethnic Russian, but it's whatever is remained of the former empire with Russian language, of course, being lingua franca and leading language in the empire. So that's the countries that, if it continues and the current policies and tactics continues, are on the really front line. With the rest of the countries mentioned here, again, at this point, no one can be sure, because certainly what Russia does today, it challenges the West not only in the former post-Soviet space. So aircrafts are going on La Manche and challenging U.S. ships in the Black Sea and so on and so forth. So it's again, the question is how serious Mr. Putin is, but certainly he's serious enough to challenge the West in that way. And irrespective of his real plans, there is a high level of anxiety in those countries because they were under Soviet/Russian control for a long period of time. I was talking to very rational people, political scientists in Michigan. A political scientist in Michigan, she is of Polish descent, and she told me that at one of the conferences, six of them, all political scientists here in the U.S. coming from Poland, met together and took the vote. Five out of six said that if Russia attacks, NATO doesn't protect them. So that's how serious NATO and U.S. is. This is this solidarity. This is a question mark in Poland, for example. And irrespective of the reality of relations within NATO, there is also a big historical component. The France and Britain promised to protect Poland back in 1939, and then really did very, very little. So that there is also history to this, to that kind of concerns. But again, among targets of current Russia's policy are not just individual countries, but the unity of NATO, EU, and West in general.
Okay. Well, here's a follow up in a way to your last point, or to the point of five of those six political scientists. How badly have the U.S. economic sanctions hurt Russia? How effective have they been?
Well, we don't know yet. But what can be said with some degree of certainty is that they hurt more than anyone expected them to hurt, because they coincided with the fall of prices for oil and gas, which are one of the main sources of hard currency for Russia, and in that way also just the psychological impact on the on business relations between West and Russia was enormous. Normally, from what I hear and what I understand, the sanctions really start biting maybe in the second year or third year since they were introduced. But it looks like that in case of Russia, because of this number of things coinciding things, they hurt more. And then there is the flight of capital from Russia, which was enormous and continues today, and again, which can be good for Russian economy. So the exact extent, I don't know. I don't think anyone knows at this point, but it's bigger than it was expected.
Okay, and here are a couple of questions about the economy of the Ukraine. Do you see a clear path to economic prosperity for Ukraine? And a related one is, if the eastern part of Ukraine were to break off and end up as part of Russia, or at least separate from the West, how economically viable would the rest of the Ukraine, would the western part of Ukraine be?
Well, I don't see clear path to prosperity. I don't see unclear path to prosperity as well. So the task on the agenda today is economic survival, because a part of the country that was responsible for, I don't know, good 15-20% of GDP is now under occupation or completely ruined. So coping just with that, forget everything else, is a major issue. So Ukraine's task is basically to stabilization, economic stabilization. That's the best case scenario for now. Regarding the rest of Ukraine being viable or not, my understanding is that this is not anymore kind of a likely scenario. The plan of creating new Russia collapsed. Russia doesn't know what to do with the territories that it took over. It is a very expensive project, not only in terms of running the war, but also this region, both Crimea and that eastern part of Ukraine, they were one of the most depressed areas in the country. Donbas area, it's a classic rust belt. It was subsidized from Kyiv because it's too expensive now to get coal on the surface. It's too expensive. It's easier to to bring it from outside of the country, but you can't close the mines because there are millions and millions of people, and this is a social disaster and explosion. So it's a very expensive thing. With the rest of Ukraine recovered from the shock of the Russian invasion. The idea that Russians could invade, or that there could be war with Russia, or it could be go in the way that it could be stopped, was unthinkable for Ukrainians. It's not just Mr. Putin who was saying, okay, they're the same nation. Many believe, okay, we are not the same, but we are brotherly. It's in Eastern Ukraine, we speak the same language. It's impossibility. So Ukraine by now recovered from that shock. It was able to put together the army that can fight. And what was possible early in 2014 in terms of 20 people coming to the town and taking over the city hall and declaring that this is a People's Republic of so and so are basically impossible today. I don't want to overestimate the degree of the unity of Ukraine, but there is degree of unity that wasn't there before, and it's not on based on cultural language, but again, the patriotism and belonging and the hope transformations and European future. Because what happened in 2013 when Ukrainians went on the streets? They went on the streets when their government refused to sign association agreement with EU. It wasn't about membership in EU. It wasn't about membership in NATO. It was a lousy association agreement. But for most of Ukrainians, that was the hope, that not joining EU, but trying to bring EU into the country, to clean in business practices and other things, that was the hope for the future. By not signing the agreement, the government took away this hope for the future. So then that was it. People went on the streets and stayed there for weeks and months in cold, almost Maine-like weather.
Okay, this is something of a related or perhaps follow-up question. Is a coherent governing structure over all of Ukraine a plausible outcome of what's going on now? And assuming it is it long-term viable?
Well, Ukraine has a tradition. As a modern state, it's a new state. Its tradition is short, 20 years something. But up until 2014, there was a tradition of nonviolence. So if in Russia they were firing at the parliament in 1993, the Ukrainian model of solving things were meeting and negotiating and reaching compromises. Some of those compromises were really awful. One of them reached after this peaceful Orange Revolution, where the incoming president, Mr. Yushchenko, agreed to change the constitution, taking certain power away from him and give to the prime minister. So they restored this constitution after the last president, Mr. Yanukovych. And the constitution makes really Ukraine ungovernable because no one has really, neither president nor prime minister has enough power to do anything, but has enough power to stop what other side is doing. And Ukraine is functioning today only because, in terms of its government structure, only because real dictate of IMF and the United States and the West, they force the president and the prime minister that belong to different parties to work together. So it's the role of the current American president ambassador in Kyiv is difficult to overestimate. So if Ukrainians are left without this kind of a pressure coming from the US and from the West, the constitution that they have now is a recipe for disaster. It's very democratic and so on and so forth, very nice, gives a lot of power to almost everybody, but at the end it's not workable, at least it's not workable in a new country and country with strong regionalism like is Ukraine. So it's this probably you wouldn't hear this too often, but this virtual dictate of IMF and the West is a good thing for Ukraine today.
Okay, well, here's another issue that affects the viability of Ukraine. What is the role of corruption in today's Ukraine?
Well, corruption generally is a term that, okay, there is a system that is not corrupt, and then it's eroded to a certain degree through corruption. When you look at the post-Soviet space, and we more know here and more written about Russia, but this would be true for Ukraine and a number of other countries, corruption is a part of the system. That's how the system was built from the collapse of the Soviet Union of 1991. So it is a huge problem. On the other hand, this is a thing that exists outside of the laws, and there are common understandings that allow the country function. So it's a huge problem that has to be dealt with, but what we saw so far in post-Soviet space, one example where it worked, and that was Georgia with President Mikhail Saakashvili, which is a small country which faced an existential crisis, Russian troops on their territory moving toward the Tbilisi, the capital, backed by the U.S. and Western countries with virtual dictatorial powers of the president, Saakashvili, who cleaned the country pretty much from corruption. But it was small, and there was really... He's not a Democrat. he is loved in the West, but he's not a Democrat. So what Ukraine is doing now and doing today, realizing the seriousness of the problem, they try to appoint in the key positions in the government people who are not linked to the existing economic and political groups and clans and lobbies. So what you see, it's controversial in Ukraine, but you see more and more people outside of Ukraine being appointed by key positions in the government. So the current minister of finance is an American, Ukrainian-American. The minister of economic development is Lithuanian. Deputy Minister of Interior is former Deputy Minister of Interior from Georgia, a woman. And this is just the top of the iceberg. Mr. Saakashvili himself, who happened to be also the president, student body of a current president of Ukraine, Mr. Poroshenko, was just appointed the governor of Odessa and southern region, which is contested region, but it is also the major Ukrainian port, and the level of corruption is beyond belief there. So he was appointed there, bringing in this Georgian experience, and just appointed another Georgian to be the head of the police in that region. So the realization that it is a major problem, and this is not just a little rust on the basically viable structure, is there, and we'll see whether that will work or not, but that's the model that the Ukrainian government is now trying, not trusting their own who in one way or another represent business groups which in Ukraine called oligarchs, the major monopolies.
Okay, here's an interesting question. You said that in 1991, Crimea voted, I think it was 54% for Ukrainian independence. What would the result have been if the vote had taken place in 2014, after 25 years of Ukraine?
Okay, it's whatever $1,000 question, because what we hear today from Moscow is, well, that the annexation of the Crimea is legitimate because there was a referendum, and at referendum there were 90% or something like that in favor of joining Russia. The problem is, of course, that no independent observers were allowed, and the region was under military occupation. Now, what do we know and what the best guesstimate can be? So we have an independent pollen coming from February of 2014, a few weeks before the Russian takeover. So the question was not either you want to join Russia, but the question was, do you want Ukraine and Russia become one state? So it's a little bit different. The Poland data for the Crimea was that there were around 40%, 34-35, which were in favor of Ukraine and Russia becoming one state, which is a huge number. I'm not going to dismiss it or something like that. But this is not half, and this is not 90%. What we also know is that the voting, they were saying that the turnout was, again, 80 or 90%. The turnout, according to the data from the Human Rights Commission under President of the Russian Federation, which was there, was that the turnout was over 30%. The Crimean Tatars were not taking part in that. So I'm not excluding that, again, it's people change their mind and they can go from 34 or 40 to 50 or 55, or maybe 60, but not 80 or 90. And the question is, if the support was so overwhelming, why Russia didn't allow international observers? That was their chance. So that's what I can say about it.
In the assumption that the Russian dissident movement is still there, even with more assassinations going on, could you tell us more about their activities and what it might mean for the future of Russia? And the other one is, looking into the future, do you think that Putin will push things too far and provoke some kind of military reaction from NATO? Which one do you want to pick?
Maybe I'll answer to the question that I have, and that will be a different compromise. Well, with the quote-unquote dissident movement, but kind of a liberal opposition to Putin's regime, one of the interpretations of the current crisis is that what is happening there is happening because Putin was really scared by the mobilization against him. A few years ago, the so-called manifestations at Bolotnaya Square in Moscow, and that basically this having destruction, military destruction, and war and confrontation with the West is one of the ways for him to deal with this opposition, to cement his power. And one thing that all things went bad for Russia, economically, politically, and otherwise, except that Putin's approval hit the roof and still stays quite high. And that brings me to the second question, which basically means that Putin really is now married to this policy. It's really, he can't back off. Keeping that high level of approval without some kind of tension and confrontation and having this imagined enemy of the West or Euro-fascists or something like that would be really difficult, and no one predicted or expected what happened with the Crimea. So I'm an optimist. I hope that it will not get there, but really Putin found himself in the situation when maybe he'll think that escalation is the only way for him to stay in Kremlin. Thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. Serhii Plokhii is Mikhailo Krzyzewski Professor of Ukrainian History at Harvard University. His research interests include the intellectual, cultural, and international history of Eastern Europe, with an emphasis on the Ukraine. Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and podcasting from our website, mpbn.net. Charles Beck is the executive producer. For Speaking in Maine on MPBN Radio, I'm Jonathan Woodward.